From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel. Our program today is about religious freedom and the lack of it in many parts of the globe. Iran, Nigeria, Myanmar, North Korea, and China are just a few of the countries cited in a recent report from the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. In all, there are more than two dozen countries listed in which religious advocates of all different faiths have been harassed, jailed, and even killed. Joining me today to talk about that report and the state of religious freedom in the world is Christina Arriaga, a vice chairwoman of the commission. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
I'm also pleased to have my colleague, Michael Lippin, joining me today. Michael Lippin is an editor for the Persian Service. He has also written quite a bit about Asia and Mideast issues. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Rebecca. It's great to be here.
Well, I want to talk first about USERF, as the acronym is, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. What exactly is the commission about, and when was it started? It's fairly recent.
Yes, thank you very much. And I'm super excited to be here at Voice of America. My family's Cuban-American, and many of my relatives, the only news they got for many years were from VOA in Cuba. So thank you for your hard work. The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom was created roughly 20 years ago by Congress. It is the only institution of its kind in the world. And what we do is we focus with laser-like precision on religious freedom issues so that we raise the profiles of people who are suffering because of their religious beliefs. The State Department has an International Religious Freedom Office, but State Department is more complicated because they have commercial and other interests when they go to a negotiating table. And what we do at USERF is we make sure that religious freedom continues to be a priority for the United States government. The commission is comprised of nine commissioners from all over the United States, all over religions, Republicans and Democrats. And we agree to disagree on everything except that religious freedom is a core vital human right, not the little sister or the poor little sister of the human rights community.
Well, you released a report this year. Before we get into the specifics about the report, just kind of generally, what is the overview of religious freedom in the world?
Yes, we are congressionally mandated to issue a report. In 2018, we reported on 27 countries, and we report not only on these countries, but we make recommendations to the Department of State, the White House, and Congress on measures that should be taken to inspire these countries to respect religious freedom. Unfortunately, Pew Institute reports that over 80% of people in the world live in countries where there are serious hindrances to religious freedom, and that is a huge concern for us at USERF.
And you mentioned quite a few of those concerns in your summary report. I'm going to toss to Michael now because I know he has some specific questions about a certain region of the world.
I do, Rebecca. Thank you. Christina, one thing we've heard a lot about in terms of Iran is the situation of the Baha'i minority. What can you tell us about what kind of circumstances they face, and also particularly the story of the Baha'i Seven who have been arrested and sentenced to very long prison terms?
Yeah, as your audience will know, the Baha'i is a minority religion in Iran. It's not recognized in the constitution. In fact, the Baha'is are persecuted in many places around the world. In terms of the Muslim context, because they have a prophet after Muhammad, they're considered heretics. Interestingly, the Baha'i are well invested in being pacifists in education, and the Yaran, or the Baha'i Seven, years ago started an underground academy for young Baha'is who have been kicked out of school in spite of their credentials. And many of these Baha'is were so well educated in these underground schools that they were accepted at Oxford and Columbia University. And once the government found out, they were not too happy about it. So these seven Baha'i were arrested and they were sentenced to 20 years in prison. Later on, the sentence was mixed with another sentence and it was 10 years, but they all serve their term. I adopted two of them. As a USERF commissioner, I get to adopt a prisoner. So Fariba Kamalabadi and Mabash Sabed were two women for whom I advocated for many years. And as you well know, Mabash Sabed won the Pen Award in France for her poetry, and they have both been released. Unfortunately, the situation for Baha'is in Iran remains very difficult. The government has an active publicity campaign against them. And sometimes they issue hundreds of thousands of reports every month against them to incite violence against Baha'i neighbors. So unfortunately, we see Baha'is being murdered by their own neighbors sometimes.
Well, Christina, I wanted to ask you about what Iran's government has been saying about its treatment of the Baha'is. The foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, was in New York in April at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he had some interesting things to say. He said, according to the Iranian government, being a Baha'i, we see that as someone having a belief rather than a religion. What do you think of that kind of distinction?
This is a new international trend where countries are come under pressure for persecuting minorities. And then they'll say, it's a belief system. But because of security, we need to make sure that we enforce the law with all of them. And what it is, that's a direct violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 18 of the Declaration clearly states that you should be free to not only practice your religion, but to convert. And these are two things that the Baha'i cannot do in Iran and in many other parts of the world.
And what about the other argument that he made in defense of the Iranian position, which is being a Baha'i doesn't shield you from being prosecuted for any number of crimes?
Yeah, that's another. It's called the securitization argument, where countries will say, really, it's not because they're Baha'i or Christians or Muslims. This is, by the way, used very much against Muslims in Bahrain, for instance. This is a security concern, and as a result, you cannot invoke religious freedom as a cause for this person being arrested.
You highlighted quite a number of women, and some of them were in Iran, as a matter of fact. And Article 18, which you just brought up, also states that you have the right to change your religion, but that is illegal in some areas, including Iran. Tell us about some of the cases you're following.
We have many cases. For instance, in Malaysia, there was a famous Supreme Court case, Lina Joy, a woman who was a Muslim, wanted to change her identity card, and she couldn't. I was recently in Iraq, and Iraq is facing a very difficult situation where the identity cards no longer cite the religion, but they're cited in government records, so the government is massively converting people so that the representation changes. I was also recently in Burma or Myanmar, where we met with Christians and we met with minority groups who also say that they have to identify as coming from another country. In other words, if they're not Buddhists in Burma, very few religions are recognized, so you have to say that you're Pakistani or Indian, even if you've never been in those countries. So that continues to be a great issue of concern, particularly for minority religions.
And since you brought up Burma or Myanmar, we have to talk about the Rohingya. I mean, it's what's happening there? Because you also mentioned an activist, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, Pwin Phu Lat, and that was in 2016 that you wrote an article. What's happened since 2016?
In Burma, we met, the commission met with Jeje Puat, who was one of the prisoners who had been arrested. Wow, what courage. A young woman who was arrested, was out of prison, met openly with American advocates for religious freedom. And there is a great spirit of defiance in the minority religions of the Burmese people. And I think all of them are aghast at the way their brethren, the Rohingya Muslims, have been treated and the way that the Theravada Buddhist authorities have denied that there is any issues in the border. The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom sent two delegations, one at the staff level to Bangladesh, and the chairman of the commission and I, the chairman is Dr. Tenzin Dorje, the first Tibetan Buddhist to be assigned to the commission or appointed to the commission. We went, and to an official, they all denied that there were any problems in Rohingya, in the Rohingya Muslim area or the Rakhine province.
I have a question about the situation in Myanmar. Christina, who do you see as being more responsible for the problems that Rohingya and other minorities are facing? Is it the military, or is it Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the a leader of Myanmar and actually won a Nobel Peace Prize?
Yeah. There has been a worldwide campaign to call Aung San Suu Kyi to do what is right. And she has been unable to do so. When we were in Burma, it's such a young democracy. People were very fearful for the United States to openly criticize Aung San Suu Kyi, and they blamed the military government. But the fact is that she hasn't made compelling statements about the situation in the Rakhine province. The word Rohingya is a word that cannot be used. Instead, they call them Bengali, or they call it the Rakhine province. And the New York Times and several other publications had series about how the military will come. They'll have massive rapes. 9 months later, there are babies being born. These babies are sometimes thrown in the fire by the same people who come back to. It's horrible situation. It's a crisis of untold proportions, and yet Aung San Suu Kyi has not been able to foster a deal where she can preserve the democracy, but at the same time protect the human rights of these Muslims.
What can the United States do in practical terms to step in, make policy, make recommendations? What can it do to stop this kind of violence against a religious minority?
Well, Congress has given the Department of State, Department of Treasury, a number of tools that they can use. For our agency, the first thing is raising awareness. The crisis of the Rohingya Muslims is undeniably a horrible human rights situation, but very few people in the United States are abroad know that there were 1.2 million Christians in Iraq before the conflict, and now there are only about 200,000 left. I spoke to people from the town of Bartolo, and that was a Christian town. Nothing says Iranian influence like the fact that the new element school is called the Ayatollah Khomeini School. The Iranians have influenced Iraq, and the United States invested millions and millions of dollars, and many people lost their lives over this conflict. So raising awareness of the issue is number one. Also, there's something called the Global Magnitsky Act. And what it is Congress said that individuals who are involved in torture or individuals that are involved in human rights violations should not send their kids to Harvard, should not be able to come here to do Christmas shopping. And the Department of Treasury has a responsibility to identify those individuals. Senator Lankford, for instance, because of the situation with Pastor Andrew Brunson in Turkey, introduced an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act saying that the F-35s that were supposed to be sent to Turkey will not be sent until Andrew Brunson is released. So there's a lot of things that Congress can do.
Since you brought up the pastor, why don't you explain who he is and how he ended up in Turkey and now in prison?
Pastor Andrew Brunson and his wife Noreen pastored a small church in Izmir for 23 years. In October of 2016, he was detained. Many pastors had been kicked out of the country, and this is post-coup attempt, so he thought the same would happen to him and his wife. Instead, he was not charged, but sent to a cell, which was supposed to hold 8 prisoners, and instead he was with 20 prisoners. He was the only American, the only Christian, the only pastor. My colleague, Commissioner Sandy Jolly, and I flew to Izmir and went to a high-security prison to visit him. We were strip-searched on the way in. It was an unforgettable experience. We were put in what seemed to me like an interrogation room with a formica table and only one pen and 3 empty sheets of paper that we could use. And we waited for this pastor to come in, and in comes a shadow of the man we had seen in photographs. He has lost over 50 pounds since he was in prison. He was only charged recently of being involved in the coup. There's absolutely not a shred of evidence against him. And the judge, it's a kangaroo court, has ruled that the defense cannot bring any witnesses to testify on his behalf. The only piece of evidence that they presented was a video of a common rice and meat from Turkey being made. And Pastor Brunson's daughter has sent a video to him. And the judge said this means that he's a gula. It's a gulenist delicacy. And that means that he's a gulenist. The prosecution is calling for 35 years in prison. And it's outrageous what's going on. It's a fellow NATO country. This should not be happening.
What has the United States government been saying or doing about the situation of religious minorities in Turkey who are under pressure right now?
The situation in Turkey, human rights-wide, is terrible. I think that we possibly saw the last free elections that will be held in Turkey, and they were not entirely free. There are no journalists in Turkey. The Alevi, which are, by the way, an enormous amount of the population in Turkey, it belongs to a minority Muslim religion. They're not even recognized. The Ecumenical Patriarch is out of Istanbul, and he's been there when Istanbul was Constantinople, and his religion is not recognized. The monastery to train Orthodox priests has been closed for years, and the international community has called to reopen it. I think that all Christians, and in fact, I think that all foreigners are in great danger in Turkey. They have been Germans arrested, they have been French people arrested, subsequently released. The head of Amnesty International was arrested. The bottom line is Turkey is vital to that part of the world, and every attempt has been made by the international community to incentivize Erdogan to behave in a way that represents what Turkey wants to be, which is part of the world community. And instead, he has crushed anyone who has advocated for human rights, free speech, or religious freedom.
We're going to take a quick break just to remind you that we're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Did you know that our PC USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes? You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Coffee Bee of Kazmazi, Ghana, a listener and Facebook fan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA or on our webpage at voanews.com/PCUSA. Joining me today to talk about the state of religious freedom in the world is Christina Arriaga, a vice chairwoman of the Commission on International Religious Freedom, an independent, bipartisan U.S. government advisory body that monitors religious freedom around the world. So there's lots of strife in the world, and a lot of strife is caused by religious fights or religious control. And one of those countries might be Nigeria. And so it's cited in your report. Tell us about Nigeria.
The situation broadly when it comes to individuals or groups using a religious identity to do bad things doesn't help religious freedom. But I have to say that I often hear the argument that religion is part of the problem, not part of the solution. And at USERF, we don't think that's true. Many bad things are done in the name of race and in the name of ethnicity. But no one says, let's get rid of race, let's get rid of ethnicity and pretend we are all the same. What's happening in Nigeria is a complex political situation. There has been a lot of finger pointing, a lot of great needs, a lot of inefficiency and corruption in the government. And even though we're looking at possibly a massive exodus from all over Africa into Europe that Europe has not really looked at or considered, the international community has been unable to foster cooperation between all the groups in Nigeria. You also have the neighboring issues with the Boko Haram, with terrorist groups that are moving from one place to another. It used to be that in 1948, there were only a number of countries. Well, now we have massive groups that are as big as countries that are incredibly well-funded, moving from place to place. And there's no, in the international jurisprudence, there are no vehicles to handle those situations. The State Department recently started something called Entities of Particular Concern, where we can identify those entities. But it is a very complex situation in Africa.
What kind of a threat does Boko Haram pose to people in Nigeria today?
Well, Boko Haram has destroyed many of the economy in the neighboring countries. And it's a very interesting fact. And actually, Valerie Hudson at Texas A&M University wrote a terrific book called Sex in the World, in which she identified that the number one predictor of whether or not a country was going to achieve peace or stability is how they treated their women. And there have been many recent studies where men and women join Boko Haram because the men in these countries are unable to pay the bride price for their communities. And having a family and having a bride is very important to them. So they become part of these terrorist organizations. So right now, the economic instability in all of the neighboring countries will have an effect on Nigeria.
There are other countries in the world, of course, that are having these issues. But I wanted to get back because you said something very interesting about the number of Iraqi Christians dwindling to, I mean, a minute portion of what they once were. Where have they been dispersed? And what happens? I mean, not just Iraqis, but Coptics in Egypt, Jews in Iran. I mean, where do they go? Where can they find a welcome home? And are they?
Many of the Christians fled to the West. They had family in the United States. I know, for instance, that Jeff Fortenberry and Senator Ben Sasse have welcomed many of them to Nebraska. They have a very large community of Yazidis and also of Christians there coming from Iraq. Many of them can't go home, so they're internally displaced. And many of them accepted payment from Iranians that paid to buy their property in order to demographically change the towns in which they live, and they no longer feel safe. Many of them want to stay. There is a very courageous priest, Father Salar, in Telescuf, north of Mosul, who has been trying to incentivize the young people to stay there. So actually, the Hungarian government has given him a grant to start revitalizing the economy. But it's really difficult when you have all these young people without jobs, without the possibility of education, and with the possibility of traveling to the West to meet their relatives, even though they want to stay. The situation in the Nineveh Plains, many other countries are trying to create safe zones, but the militia is so big. I mean, there are over 200,000 people who have joined the militia. All of them are disparate groups. They're very well trained, and they have weapons from Iran. How is that going to play out when the Christians' numbers are getting smaller and smaller?
Well, I just wanted to ask Christina, how do you see this trend progressing into the future? How much more do you think that Christian community in the Middle East will dwindle? And what can USERF do about it?
Well, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom has consistently asked State Department to put together programs to incentivize the Christians being there. But we recently heard from, for instance, the Syrians, the Christian Syrians who want to stay and are receiving some assistance from humanitarian groups. But their situation is incredibly difficult. Many of the Christians we talked to said that they could not go to refugee camps because they were ostracized. They talk about women being raped in these camps and sectarian violence breaking out. So any of them that have any possibility of traveling to the West will do. I know the Yazidis, for instance, there's still 3,000 women missing that are in ISIS hands across the border in Syria. And this is so disgusting and sad. They're rangers that will go into these communities and ask the parents for money, and then they'll go back and bring back a girl who was kidnapped at 15, who was sold 20 to 25 times, is coming to a community without medical assistance, without psychiatric assistance. So the government of Canada has very kindly taken 1,000 Yazidi families, and the government of Germany has taken 800 families, but many of them are without any assistance from the international community. They want to be in Sinjar. They want to be in their province. They want to go back to their homeland, but they can't for three reasons. One is because those areas, many of them are still occupied. If they're not occupied, they're planted with mines, and these are agrarian societies. And third, again, Erdogan continues to threaten to invade the province of Sinjar and destabilize the region once again. So they're in camps that were supposed to last for 2 or 3 months. I've been in these camps for 4 or 5 years.
There have been reports in the news over the past couple of years about a rise in anti-Semitism in the West, but also we've seen attacks on synagogues in, say, Tunisia or North Africa. What is going on there? Have you seen a rise in anti-Semitism in your reports?
Absolutely. We have seen a surprising rise in anti-Semitism, and the United Nations actually is holding a number of groups specifically to talk about this. But this has been going on for some time, even in places like France, where the Jewish community was banned from wearing yarmulkes. At the same time, Muslims were barred from wearing hijabs and wearing headscarves, and the Sikhs, who had nothing to do with anything, were told that they couldn't wear turbans, they couldn't send their children to school. This has been brewing for a long, long time in Europe. Once you start isolating communities and refuse to even educate them, they no longer feel part of the society. And as a result, they create their own belief systems, which then are contrary to the national interests of the country that isolated them.
Well, I wanted to see if we can go back to Iran for a moment. There are a couple of other minority religious groups that we haven't talked about yet, but your counterpart at the State Department, U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, he said he was horrified in his report in May about the situation of some of these other groups who include Sunnis, for example. I did a report just recently about Iran's most prominent Sunni cleric, by the name of Molavi Abdul Hamid Ismail Zahi, who actually isn't allowed to travel outside of his own province except for the capital, Tehran. Why do you think it is that Iran has been treating its Sunni minority in this way?
It's hard to tell how Iran justifies any human rights violation. I think that any religion that threatens to have its own individual assessment of human rights facts become a threat. We see this in Bahrain, a minority Sunni with a large Shia population, but the minority Sunni ruled the Shia. We see this in Saudi Arabia. We see that in the entire Gulf region. And in Iran in particular, since 1979, since the revolution, the state is the religion, and the religion is the state. And anything outside of those boundaries becomes a threat. And in fact, this is a trend in many countries. Religion can start, religious freedom means that there's a strong civil society, and that becomes a threat to any authoritarian regime, whether it's Cuba or Iran, is the same attitude towards religions that are getting people involved in non-state-sponsored activities.
Well, there's another Muslim sect in Iran that also has been under pressure. They're called dervishes. Many of them, in fact, hundreds were arrested in February during a protest in Tehran that turned violent. What can you tell us about Iran's dervishes and the way they're perceived by majority Shiites and the government?
Yeah, it's a very small group of individuals who have a different belief system, like the Baha'i, like the Sunnis. They have become a threat. The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom has been closely monitoring what has been going on in Iran with them. We're very concerned about the recent prison sentences. That is, unfortunately, what they normally do in Iran when they want to not only intimidate the person, torture the person, but intimidate a whole community. So the fact that women were arrested during this march and they have been given very harsh sentences becomes problematic. It has a chilling effect on not only that particular religion, but any of the other minority religions in Iran.
I want to get back to the report very quickly, because if anybody is interested in looking it up online, you can give the website. But also, just briefly, you have a Tier 1 and Tier 2, I noticed, and if you could explain what that means. So if somebody goes on the website and they're looking at it, and just how do you differentiate between the two?
Well, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, userv.gov, publishes this report every year. They have for the last 20 years. As there are 27 countries there right now. We recommend that countries be placed in what is called a CPC list, country of particular concern, for egregious and systematic ongoing human rights violations, so violations of religious freedom. What that does is that the State Department, once someone gets on that list, can implement economic measures against these states, these countries, or they can also have targeted sanctions for the individuals involved in the violations of religious freedom. No country likes to be listed as a CPC. No country wants to be included in the list. We at USERV have been a little bit more aggressive. We recommended that 16 countries be placed on this list. This year, the State Department placed 10 of these 16 countries and then placed Pakistan in an official watch list. Pakistan, you know, we see developments that we think are going to improve the situation. But then we see people like Asia Bibi, a Christian who was a woman who was accused of blasphemy, still sentenced to death in prison, hasn't been released.
Oh, Christina, I just wanted to ask about these designations of countries of particular concern. How effective are these in getting those countries to change the ways they treat minorities?
That is a key question to our work at USERV. And we address every country individually. Some countries, like Cuba, they react very well to international pressure. Some countries, like Vietnam, let us on for some time saying that they were going to draft a new religious freedom law. And they drafted what was a tiny bit better because Vietnam doesn't want to be on a CPC list. They were at one point. However, none of those changes have been implemented. We know for a fact that when Vietnam was listed as a CPC country, there were some improvements of the situation for particular groups. So the question is always, when you implement any kind of sanction or embargo, who is most affected? Is it the people that you're trying to protect, or is it the government officials? How is the economy affected by this? So these are issues that we take into consideration whenever we're looking at sanctions.
And unfortunately, we're going to have to end it there. Very, very interesting discussion. Religious freedom is of a lot of interest to our listeners, I'm sure. Thanks so much for joining us today, Christina Arriaga. And thanks to my colleague, Michael Lippin, one of the editors for VOA's Persian service. Christina Arriaga is a vice chairwoman of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, or USERF, an independent bipartisan U.S. government advisory body that monitors religious freedom around the world and makes policy recommendations to officials in the U.S. government, just like you were talking about. Thanks also to our engineer, Justin Thwaites, and thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Rebecca Ward. Tune in again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.